Blog Talk Radio.
I think the reproduction of that song is really, that music is really quite exceptional. You know, you can imagine the original, all the squeaks and pops. And of course, at the time, we would ood and odd over it, just the same as we do today. However, how are you? It's good to have you. Good to have you back. Good program today. And I think what I'd like to do with this program is give listeners a chance to examine questions that they may be on their mind, but for whatever reason might be complicated to discuss with their mates, with their lodge mates. And on the program, I hope that we can provide a few ideas, ways of approaching these questions with a bit of finesse and a bit of delicacy. And yes, I can tell that we're talking about dealing with aggressive and assertive personalities. Yes, I expect that. Masonry, as you know, if you look around, there's a refinement, of course, but the intensity is handled with dignity. We don't need to stand up and be overbearing because there's confidence in the room. We have the security of the meal that we feast on, the constant meal that we feast on, the meaning, the primacy of knowing that there is information, and that yes, we can honor and distinguish opinion, but we can also develop opinions about questions that aren't necessarily obvious. And you know, not to belabor the point, questions about a good life and what is justice and things like that. Well, if a person hears that kind of thing and doubts that it has any bearing, then it has no, you know, what bearing does it have? However, there is this other question that comes to my mind, and perhaps a lot of you. If we aren't aware, does it mean that those laws and those principles apply nevertheless? I've thought about that a bit, and I'd love to hear your comments about it. But I think the answer, if there is a single answer, which I kind of doubt, is that it does. I don't necessarily, if you ask me to explain to you quantum physics, I can understand Planck's thinking. I can understand a little bit in little slices at a time. But overall, it does become very challenging, and to just the comprehension takes time, takes a great deal of time and thought, but the principles and the laws apply nevertheless. I may not understand the effects of laws of motion, but laws of motion prevail. It's kind of, in a way, it's like common sense. If a man doesn't use common sense, is he still bound by common sense? And I would say yes. If common sense tells you not to step into the hole, and a person steps into the hole, common sense doesn't just disappear. It doesn't vanish. It frames the act. Why did you step in the hole? Why did you step in the hole when you knew common sense told you not to? Common sense is like a philosophical truth that we all just accept. We, in its simplest terms, which is the type of mathematics that I enjoy, the idea that we take very complicated issues and complicated problems, break them down into their simplest components. That being able to do that, I think that's my definition of genius. And I often have little homilies along the way that make me feel, that seem to satisfy me about physicists, old physicists teaching, and renowned physicists teaching the little girl from next door arithmetic. And I think how perfect, how absolutely perfect and how dignified that this child who has, and I would think with the sense of child being innocent, is being taught, and how important it is. It's like the greatest pianists in the world doing their scales, limbering up the fingers, doing the scales. It's the same way you and I are the violinists. You do the basics. You do them, but you do them. You do them incredibly well. And you bring intonation, you bring emotion out of the notes, the sounds. Oh my goodness! So that's a part of Masonic effects that I think I don't want to dismiss. Allow us to be a place to rehearse, to examine the. And it's not to say we're rogue at all. But it is to say that it's reasonable to practice before we jump in. And by practice, I mean have an opportunity when we're not feeling pressured or distracted, think through the logic and think through the reactions that we're likely to experience. And likely is that we can't predict ahead of time. But after thousands and thousands and thousands of repetitions, and like the ideas of Meissner, through a couple of thousand years of men passing along ideas and discussions, and those ideas and discussions, certain ideas and discussions, spreading throughout cultures around the world. We scratch our head and wonder, how did it happen over in that old culture, over in China, when it was happening in Africa and it was also happening in Britain? How does it, that spontaneity, was it, of course, if you're prone to your history and science from the back of a cereal box, it's the stuff of conspiracy theory. It must be an alien presence, because it's easier to accept that kind of a description than it is to think that there were men there were minds that were capable of advanced science, and somehow we lost that continuity. Much easier to suggest it's an alien presence that unknown variable and introduce that. And then you think there's a bit of correctness in all of that. Nice day today. Good program. The Deep Indulgence. I hope you like that as a commentary. I know that Masonry talks about serious things, but I don't think we talk about it in a glum. We're not funeral directors. I know some, not to say, and I know my friends who are funeral directors will say, "What up?" No, I'm not saying that you're a solemn lot. You're, as we know, but there's times when we show a bit of dignity and a bit more in dignity to the subject, and a bit more not only dignity but respect. So that's where we are here. How if I'm trying to walk that balance, so it's not so glum, and I don't want to. I don't want to have the, I don't think the Orwellian, I don't want to present this as the Orwellian, you know, a dystopian sense of the word, and we need to cling to the life raft of Masonry. No. Life goes on, and we can describe certain, in any kind of a situation, if you ask a group of us to look at the situation through a particular lens, through a particular way of thinking, we can do that. We can do that, and we can convince. In doing that, we can actually convince ourselves that there's a correctness or an accuracy, or a truth or a purity to what we're thinking and saying. Obviously, as I see that, and I tell you about that, that is my truth. There is no other truth except now. We have these tools of divine accountability, and a lot of us are walking around with them in our pockets. I'm talking about the computing technology in your cell phone, easy to retrieve. I just adore what it's doing to despotism and the oligarchs, and there's no place to hide anymore. They're being revealed. Now, of course, we have this new we, the population of the world. And yes, I know the hunger and the slavery. Yes, I know. I'm talking about people that have access. And no, I'm not losing track of my conscience about the degradation of the human condition that's around us. None at all. I'm talking about this new power of accountability. Like I tell you, I can assert this is what happened. That's what the person looked like. This is their features. And yet we have these little things, cameras that are taking pictures. And you're going to immediately say, of course, that can be manipulated. We have AI that just did that with a very popular young woman because of her celebrity. And of course, it's always vile and salacious. I mean, unfortunate that people would abuse. Not so necessarily unusual. Too often, the media will make that appear as if that kind of behavior is quite common with our overgrown sons in their basements. With a video game in the dark and pizza boxes stacked around them. No, the real world isn't like that. We have those oddities, but we always have. We've had those extremists. We always have. And we know that. And we've had different remedies for that over time. Now we're trying to be a bit more humane and answer that because it defines what we are as a species and how we and talks and it speaks about our cultures. This is where we are able to hold up those images and say, "This is what you said. This is what you said," but that's not what happened. Here, take a look at this picture. All of a sudden, we were asking questions about brain and mind. Oh my goodness. Well, you know, it's easier for us to talk about conspiracy theory and alien injections of technology than it is for us to begin to understand brain and mind. Well, you know, I'm not saying we're doing that on purpose. I'm saying it's just a fact. This is, we are complicated. Oh my goodness, we are. Not only are we the only consciousness that we know of in the entire universe, as of today, and think about the expansion, and think about the numbers, incomprehensible numbers. Hundreds of billions of galaxies with hundreds of billions of stars. And now we have this idea that, you know, it's like another earworm. My ears are full of these earworms about infinite space. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, there we go. It was so simple when I was, you know, you could just be stupid or just be uninformed. But it's so much sweeter. It's so much of an indulgence to go through life just looking at the things that we don't know, that each day we can wake up trying, if we have the mindset, we can wake up attempting to figure it out. And as we go along, doing that, having that as a lifestyle, as a backstop, does something to in the way that people react to us. Because it's very, very hard to remain angry at the world and live with a chip on our shoulder, because anger and temper is a temporary anger is a temporary emotion. If you see somebody that's carrying anger all the time, pretty much all the time, there's something else wrong with the wiring. For a healthy, and I will assume the majority of us are like that, healthy, responsive human beings, anger is a flashpoint. It's a protection. You know, we can go so far, but then you trigger anger, and it's a mechanism of self-protection. But it is temporary. So when we see that, we witness that in our lodge communities, it's the observer, without having the conversation, quote, knows, quote, a great deal about that, a person expressing that, a tremendous amount. You can decide this is, you know, you look at the bully, typically somebody being aggressive, and think, oh my goodness, a lion of society, a domineering, dominant in the room, yeah, alpha male. Or you can look at it in terms of the chink in the armor, the expression of vulnerability. No, who would do that? Well, diplomats would, negotiators would. If you're sitting over the chessboard, we would. We're looking for vulnerabilities, aren't we, in thinking. And that's one of many, many difficulties and shortcomings of that lifestyle, of that way of thinking, that motif. Always angry, always ready to dominate. No, I'm not talking about the wife beaters out there. I think they're stupid, but I'm talking about, for whatever their reason, the stupid and misguided little creatures. No, I'm talking about the world that we live in. These things happen. The power. Let me get back to that. The power that we have brought to us by this tool means what? We haven't had it before. As a culture, we haven't had this. We've had accountability, but not in the hands of the citizenry. And as we know, when people, citizens group, is introduced to a new level of a power, they use it. And it, like anything else, you think about it, thank you to the field of the arts and sociology in particular. Oh, it's abused. It's not perfected. Before I say abuse, that's making a judgment. It's not perfected, so it's awkward. It's like baby steps. We fall. We fall a lot. And we learn from hindsight. We learn from, you know, if we don't learn from those kind of things, then it lessens and weakens the foundations of our culture. Not because I'm saying it, because the great thinkers have made that examination, and we have documented these things repeatedly. There's so much consistency in this observation. And the science of these observations are consistent. Masonry comes along and helps us with this at arm's length, and your arm's length, your sleeve length is different than mine. And our timing is different because we're not all of the same age, of the same mind, of the same culture. So think of the formula that you're working with. Does it apply whether we're aware of it or not? Well, I would think, I hope we're agreeing. Yes, it does apply. Ought we to understand it? I would think for most of us, yes, it would be wise to understand it. And then the effect. The effect is, I don't know, there's another word for accountability. That you will have. I don't always have the right words for it. There's another word for accountability. Is it knowing? Is it precision? Is it truth? And then that's where, in my thinking, I like nice, clean lines and boxes. But I find as I go along that those nice lines that my brain likes, nice categories, it's simple, I can use routine, tend to fade. And the fading is about, I become more understanding. Then the differences are more refined. The edges are more thinner and thinner and thinner until they're almost non-existent. And then some of you whisper in my ear about, hey, have you read any Hermetics? Have you studied? And then, you know, we start, where do you start? I'm looking at the Tree of Life and I'm trying to, and I think, well, do I understand the Sephiroth and how it fits together? Well, the joy is just savoring that and attempting it and making those little aha discoveries and defining this mass of humanity that is going through life and trying to pick up as much as you possibly can. Thankfully, I'm a part of this group that encourages us to tackle these things, acknowledge that these are difficulties, you know, they're challenges. But a gentleman can do it with a bit of grace and dignity. We make life look easy, and it's not. And how we do that is, while we may be wearing the weight of the world on our shoulders, we have the time to be generous and to be thoughtful of people around us. And to even think of the person that has no advantage for us. There's no gain from helping that widow. I'm not looking for any fame or anything material. In fact, what else is there if you're not operating on those premises? There's reason. You do it because it's the right thing to do. I know it sounds simple, but that's the beauty of it all. So let's take a walk through this mind garden again today. I told you about the commentary today, the deep indulgence, and you know that we're getting into a part of history written by people that had the wherewithal to write down perspectives on what was going on in Amsterdam lodges with enough detail that it's a thrill for us. It answers so many questions about them and about us. A little music, perhaps? Just a taste of what's likely to come? Yeah. Let me try this and see if everything's set up again. This is a little Miles Davis. Oh. Thank you. Went from, got into a little Paul Blay there as well. The commentary today is the deep indulgence. Sit back with your sipping, whatever that might be, and help me with this. Whether we are satisfied with masonry depends where we look for satisfaction. There are a few barriers to the experience of masonry other than a lack of imagination and a lack of self-discipline. Those character traits, fortunately, are always lurking close by. It's not that we lack them, it's we don't use it. It's not that we can't be self-disciplined, it's that we don't. Your depth as a person will be evident in some way to those around you. We normalize this thinking by educating ourselves in the way of a way of life, way of thinking. There's different forms of that. We are talking here about Freemasonry. Philosophical explanations are such a release that people with that ability have no reason to doubt it. Somehow life goes on. If we are curious about the nature of masonry in our context, there is an easy way to test the validity. Simply be yourself. Read as you will, and inevitably, like-minded will find you as you find them. Tensions, they're boyish transgressions. Meaningless in the big scheme of things. What is far more interesting, I find, is the way the goal of understanding removes conflict. It's harder to be angry about things going on that don't make sense to us if we understand them. We may then not accept them. We may then realize what we like, you know, the confirmation bias of what I'm seeing needs to fit with what I generally think. Oh, so much for evidence, eh? Those are things we know about each other. It is uncanny knowing we do not have to participate. It's far more interesting, I find, the way the goal of understanding removes that conflict. But we don't have to. I like to think there are ways to rise above it. We work best when we all assume accountability to a greater truth. It is not asserting our own mindset. This is the way it is probably, without examination, is probably probably delusional, probably, you know, probably outside the frame. It's I say probably because I don't want to offend friends. It's the difference in our world between law and justice. It's why, you know, we put in, we talk about this symbol, Solomon. Yeah, some of us try to, we want to examine that literally, but the chair has become a symbol of wisdom. How does that fit with your thinking? Yeah, all that in me street. Oh, there, you can tell the, you can tell the, you can tell the state of this fool, huh? Let's see what you think. Would be nice if we had a little music come our way, wouldn't it? Goodness. Art Farmer. actually. Remarkable music. I needed to, searching for poetry for the show, which is always a pleasant thing to do. And my original piece, If I Die, I'm censored because right now in the world, it's politically charged. And I had to think of that. I have listeners from various faiths around the world, and I didn't want to interrupt that connection between us. So I censored that out. In my mind, I went to something that was opposite. And I think it's because of his name. I generally think of Robert Lee Frost's work, Robert Frost, as fairly benign. I don't think of him as tackling the meatier topics of life. And that's my association of that name, you know. But I'm wrong. I'm short-sighted. And I wanted to demonstrate that to everyone. And this comes from my discovery of this article from Case Western Reserve University by Sarah Gridley, the associate professor of English, in which she says, if you think poetry is not sufficiently interactive, it might help to remember that the word stanza means room in Italian. Imagine yourself walking through a series of rooms when you progress through the parts of a poem. Poetry is fundamentally an art of making, from the Greek verb poiein, to make or create. If you can keep in mind this physical sense of language, you'll have a keener experience of moving through the poem and letting it move through you. And here, the obvious. If you find poetry confusing, remember Robert Frost's idea that a poem's task is not to resolve confusion, but to clarify it. If you find poetry boring, stay with that boredom. See where it takes you. It's easy to supplant boredom by engaging with some form of electronic distraction. Try unplugging for a while. As her friend, G.C. Waldrop, recently wrote, "One beauty of poetry for me is that since its advent in my life, I have never been bored. Poetry means never being bored again, among other things." And lastly, if you think poetry is too pretentious, too detached from everyday reality, I hope you will enjoy the following haiku from 18th century Japanese poet Yoshi Busun. Fallen petals of the red plum, they seem to be burning on the clods of horse shit. There we go. So, born 1874 in San Francisco, and he died after I was born in January 1963, the period of big, big 19-foot cars. Big fins. Here. This is not dystopian. Oh, my goodness. I'm not a big fan of doing that on the show, but we can examine it. We can examine it. There's themes in this poem. This is about the night, acquainted with the night. And it's a short poem, and it takes us into the mind of the speaker and hopefully into something that's either familiar or that we can acknowledge within ourselves. Someone has journeyed deep into their own psyche and discovered darkness. And despite of being in a city surrounded by a whole lot of people, you know, it's like you're alone in the room, a crowded room. And this could be a metaphor for depression or despair or loneliness, or as I would think, a state of mind and an awareness. We aren't of all of these things. It could be Robert Frost's own inner world, but we don't know that. Dante used the term terza rima form for the Divine Comedy, and Frost's poem echoes the descent into a dark place where time has no meaning and words are useless. Here, I have been one acquainted with the night. I have walked out in rain and back in rain, and I have outwalked the furthest city light. I have looked down the saddest city lane. I have passed by the watchman on his beat and dropped my eyes, unwilling to explain. I have stood still and stopped the sound of feet when far away an interrupted cry came over houses from another street. But not to call me back or say goodbye, or further still, at an unearthly height, one luminary clock against the sky proclaimed the time was neither right nor wrong. I have been one acquainted with the night.
Thank you.
Curtis Fuller. Yeah, very, very cool. For fans of trombone at its best. I want to, getting to history, which is at the looking back over our shoulder and something that happened before, and it seemed always to fit at this part of the program. Yeah, not the end, but a retelling of what was going on yesterday. And before I get into this, I just want to frame it with a bit of context that I'm part of a large process is that where we do speak in code, and it's the oddest kind of thing. Odd, but not odd. We form in groups of men as part of an organization. And this is, an important departure. Our organization outlines that we are gentlemen who are thoughtful, who probe, who understand, appreciate, and apply ethics and principles to our life in the pursuit, motivated to understand a good life, to understand the meaning of justice and et cetera. And that we are governed by a gentility that's described for us. It's not about us, but it's described for us. You know, this humble man who goes about his business and commits those acts of kindness, not because of his own understanding, but because he's observed the need and he's fulfilling that need. Now, I remember, my goodness, a fellow being quite cross that he bought a great big sailboat and he expected all of the teenagers in the family would love to spend their weekends sailing with grandpa, only to find, no, they weren't. They had their own lives and got busy like teenagers have been doing in urban centers for how long. So he was quite disappointed. But to soothe his disappointment, he turned to the same kind of thinking, but he turned to Masons in his district generally, you know, rather than going out on his own. He wasn't that kind of fellow. Well, I found tremendous solace in going out and sailing on my own. It's just, the peace of existence. Eh? So he, when I met him, he was quite disillusioned and upset that year after year he had put this invitation out there and nobody had picked up on it. And as I looked around, I thought, well, there's nobody else. You know, there's the number of sailors in the room. he and I, and I was new, and he was selling his boat, but he crossed that it was because of these other people. And I thought, what a curious mindset, you know, not to take responsibility. So the fellow that's doing, committing, you know, doing things for the sake of good, you know, it's like I often think, you know, that fellow in his own mind thought he was being quite generous, but he forgot to ask. He forgot to ask. He wasn't really paying that much attention. And so he was disappointed, which was, I think, for a lot of people, is a comfortable, familiar theme, the disappointment in people around you. You know, we can have a dystopian view and then find all kinds of evidence to support it. Like the people that come to me with ideas that explain it, this science must have come from aliens, and they're quite insistent on it, but it also has to do with the way that they think. And the way that you and I, that everybody thinks, allows us to find evidence. You know, our own, what would the advertisers call it, our own spin. You could always find evidence. It's like when we pick up a book of scripture, we can look at things metaphorically, we can look at things literally. And then, you know, the larger question is the right and wrong of it. But in the meantime, we go off on these tangents, what they call them, or with all our fistful of proof, proof that the way that we're interpreting is the correct way, except, you know, look around. So, and remember, we're if we needed a reminder, we're all in this together. So if we can want to invest or convince ourselves in investing our entire life in conflict, then, and some people do have that, I think, quite legitimate, listen to me. But as you really want to carefully examine whether your life is worth that. And I know there's a lot of qualifiers to that. Here we're talking about some clear decisions. And I think in my own way, I've tried to penetrate. I've been aware of the code. You know, we don't want to be too frank with this code. We allow our whole group to giggle or dismiss ideas of merit or the consequences of a lack of imagination or a lack of leadership. The way that we bolster our definitions tends to trivialize, at least in my view. And I thought, well, my goodness, I'm not the brightest star in the sky. And if I'm noticing these things, I'm pretty sure a lot of other people are. And I find, my goodness, yes, a lot of people are quite observant. But what do we do about that? Yeah, we don't do a lot. And it gets around to, you know, if good-minded men don't do anything, then they're likely to be governed by, you know, very terrible people. So it's an accountability that changes, is more refined as the life of our big organizations moves on. Now, as I talk to you here, I have a sense that I'm defined by Lodge. I've spoken earlier about some of the work being performed in my lodge right now. Lovely. I'm also part of a Grand Lodge, but lately I've been sincerely feeling this connection with you, with this global movement, this global fraternal movement. All in. I'm part of. I understand, and you understand, and we have this unusual transcultural connection. And it is unusual because it seems to, if you're not looking for it, it's not really noticeable. Some are, it's a bit more garish, and other places it has the subtlety that I require in my thinking, the dignity, no megaphones. But what does that have to do with the Strasbourg lodges and this portion of history? Well, give me a chance here to explain.
In general, the Strasbourg lodges, like many others in France of the day, you know, we're looking at late 1780s kind of thing. And yes, the specter of French Revolution is on the horizon, choose to widen the gap between the elite and the popular. And also between the military and the civilian. Lodges have always existed for military men, but in the late 18th century, France military lodges, often composed of minor aristocrats, some greater in number and more segregated from civilian society. This may be a statistical illusion brought about by new and better record keeping. One of the innovations imposed by the Grand Orient of the 1770s was a membership form for every brother, listing side by side civil qualities and Masonic qualities. For example, or a surgeon and orator, as well as age, place of birth, address, and signature. We might find these lists preserved in Strasbourg and other invaluable for the demography of the lodges. Their original purpose had been to keep track of social hierarchy, to make sure that enough, quote, honorable men could be found in any given lodge. The tensions between the Strasbourg lodges were expressed in discussions that concerned the meaning of social hierarchy in relation to the goal of moral perfectibility or virtue. In the socially segregated lodges of Strasbourg, we can find men speaking frankly about their betters as well as their lessers. There, the most socially elevated and thus by virtue of their birth supposedly civilized brothers sustain their own separate civil society, their closed temple. Of the 110 old Alsatian noble families, 37 were represented in the Lodge of Les Candeurs. Their statues expressed their major concerns. Charity was seen as a central duty. Admission had to be by unanimous approval and was clearly very selective. Initiation dues were very high, 129 livres. The purpose of this lodge was to be simultaneously closed and exclusive, while liberal toward the needs of the lesser society. Given the border location, lodges like Les Candeurs were also close to the German influences at work in the Central European Freemasonry. Strasbourg was something of an entrepôt between the masonry we associate with Paris and Amsterdam, and the more mystical versions to be found in Berlin and Vienna. Perhaps the best illustration of the Strasbourg version of Enlightenment culture as supported by Le Candeur Lodge lies in two societies, both with Masonic foundations and ambience. Such societies, of which there were many founded by lodges throughout continental Europe, are often described in retrospect as quasi or para-Masonic. In them, the ideals of the lodges could recruit non-Masons and the idealists of the lodge could recruit non-Masons and engage in specific projects for social reform and utility. These were the goals of similar societies set up in the west of France. Indeed, the phenomena resembles a strong, similar turn toward the practical, which has been found in the Dutch societies. By no means necessarily Masonic of the 1780s. In eastern France, the Strasbourg Society of Philanthropy and the Harmonious Society of Reunited Friends, both with strong associations with Le Candeur, were the local versions of the Enlightenment applied. The Strasbourg Philanthropic Society, in its own words, quote, is a confederation by which generous and sensible men, brought together by the charms of friendship and the attraction of a perfect equality, can impose upon themselves the constant exercise of social virtue, benevolence, a reasonable tolerance, a profound respect for the divinity, a culture of the arts and the useful sciences, and the sincere vow of enlightenment and relieve men insofar as it is within their power. And this society seeks a nation of practical philosophies. What do you think? Would you say they've been successful in their endeavor? Have they? Did they? Always influences, eh? All these influences, do they have a bearing on us? Does all this recording, and you rightfully so, we can say, well, obviously this is a select perspective. It's the perspective of writers in a particular lodge. And you think around, is there a person who can, is there a person in your lodge that you feel would be able to capture or approximate the view of the entire lodge? More likely he will express his own, and it will incorporate ideas that we share in common. More likely. The code that comes, I think, is the preservation. We have this need to attempt to provide, to preserve and protect harmony. But we haven't really, where I am, we haven't a history of speaking out loud about that, about talking about what that means to each of us, because each of us has our own examples of such things, of values. You know, that's the beauty of them, where there's more than one way of thinking, more than one way of experiencing. So are we able to find ideas, hold ideas in common? Well, yeah, we do. Our character, for reasons that we may not fully understand, is quite capable of doing that. Anyway, that's the show for today. That's Masonic Effects. I'm stumbling with still some technical problems in the background. We're working on those. We'll get them sorted out soon, I hope, real soon. But I want to thank you for your participation. It's just a pleasure to have you join us, and a shout out around the world, my goodness, at your own leisure, whether you're sipping that. I always think of you sitting at a cafe with headphones on, sipping a cup of tea or a glass of tea, or sitting in an overstuffed, comfortable, well-worn chair with a nice glass of wine, or in a room with subdued atmosphere, where you've ordered your second glass, your next glass of scotch, and you've put down your newspaper and tuned in to Masonic Effect, or you're sitting at home and you have a moment of solitude and you choose to share it with us, with me. These are, I think, representations of the audience. There are also people that tune in that are of a more occult nature, able to stretch their understanding to ask the uncomfortable questions that in polite company would be called the occultists. I call them realists. You want to, I think all of that stuff is more politicizing thinking. This is right, this is wrong. Yeah, the ethics are, it's curious. That, and I'm very, very grateful that across this entire country, I have listeners that come back and regularly tune in. The codification, the way we speak in code, It caught my attention. And I like it because when I'm the curious like you, I pick up these little rocks in the bottom of this stream of life and as I tip them up, the little trout stream and it's just perkling along. And these little salamanders, I pick this stuff. What's underneath this rock? And little, there's all kinds of little things squirming out of there. And that's fascinating. It always was. Anyway, I hope you'll come back and join us. I really do. In the meantime, a little Dexter Gordon, And thank you. Thank you, Philippines. Thank you. Thank you, South Africa. Thank you, Brazil. Thank you, Britain. Oh, my goodness. And Greece. Oh, my. I'm so, so grateful. And Russians. Thank you, brethren. North America. For all that we have, we have imperfections in our cultures and in our world. We also have some shared beliefs. And that, I think, has always been important. Come back. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. Come back. Join us in a bit of time. Here's a little Dexter Gordon to see you to your car. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.